Today on Maine Calling, live organ donation in Maine. Even before the COVID pandemic, people in need of a kidney or liver transplant faced a long, uncertain wait. Now it's worse. The number of people stepping forward as a live organ donor has dropped. Even though, medically, now more people can be donors. That's because there is no longer a need to match blood type. Nationwide, 100,000 people are waiting for a life-saving organ transplant. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will learn about live organ donation in Maine, usually involving kidney transplants. We'll also talk about the recent news-making transplant of a pig's kidney to a human, and we'll hear from some people who have stepped forward as altruistic donors, those who are not related to the recipient and donated to a stranger. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. And by Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at welchforbes.com.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. There are tens of millions of Americans who are registered to donate their organs after they die. But people who are still living can also donate certain organs, primarily kidneys. Today, we're going to learn about the need for living organ donation, how it works, who qualifies, and we'll learn about new advancements in this procedure, and we'll hear from two live kidney donors and a recipient. Joining me for this hour, Dr. Juan Palma, who is Surgical Director and Director of Living Donation at Maine Health, and Heather Stevens, a registered nurse and coordinator of the Living Donor Program, also at Maine Health. We invite you to join the conversation. Would you donate a kidney to a family member, friend, or even to a stranger? Do you have questions about it? You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Thank you both for joining us. And Dr. Palma, I'm going to start with you. How many people in Maine need a kidney donation? How many people are on your list? And how many of these transplants are you able to do every year?
Hi, Jennifer, and hi to your audience. So in Maine, we have our program is the only kidney transplant program in Maine. And we have currently 250 people listed waiting for a kidney. On average, every year, we transplant anywhere from 45 to 50 patients. So there is a local state deficit of 200 organs to close the gap of what the Maine population needs versus the organ supply.
So what are the people, the 200 people every year who are not able to find a kidney, what's their prognosis? What do they face? Are these people who will die without a kidney transplant?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So just to give you... for context, let's talk about a patient that unfortunately received the news that his or her kidneys are no longer working. So there is a fork on the road. Do I go on dialysis or do I try to seek a transplant? So speaking just about patient survival, the chances of that person to be alive on dialysis after 5 years is 1 in 3 people make it to 5 years of dialysis. After 10 years, only 1 in 10 people can make it using dialysis. If you compare that with a transplant, at 5 years, 8 out of 10 people are alive after a successful transplant. And at 10 years, about 7 out of 10 people are alive thanks to a successful transplant. So the survival advantage of kidney transplantation is very significant for patients that unfortunately face end-stage kidney disease.
Heather, I want to turn to you and ask you about how it all works. We all know about going to get our driver's license and checking if we want to be an organ donor, if we were to die. But what about for people who want to be a living donor? How does the whole system work?
Oh, that's great. Thank you, Jennifer. We have a lot of people who are interested, and how we start by having a conversation with them. We have a website that we have you go to. It's MMC, which I'm sure we'll talk about more, .donor.screen. And there is a platform there that you can fill out your demographic information and a small health history, your family history. And with that, we're connected to that platform, and we will receive an email. Also, at our website, we encourage you to visit if you have any questions, if you aren't quite sure if this is something that you would be able to qualify for. On our website, it shows all of the information which you would need, frequently asked questions, and also our direct line to speak with us directly if you have questions that we can answer for you before going through the process. It takes maybe, I've done it myself, 5 minutes to put all of your information in there. We do have some hard stops along the way. For instance, if you have a history of melanoma cancer, if your BMI is over 35, we do have hard stops, but we also encourage people to call, and a number is provided for any questions that we can answer for you. Once you have filled out the questionnaire, we will receive an email, and within 2 to 3 business days, we will reach out to you, usually sooner. We will reach out to you and discuss next steps for the patient. We will request the last 3 years of your medical history, in addition to encouraging everyone based on age and gender to have their cancer screenings done and make sure that you are well established with a primary care provider as well.
Heather, I read that nationally during the pandemic, the number of people stepping forward to be live donors plummeted. And I'm wondering if that's the case here in Maine. Are you seeing fewer people step forward?
We actually are. Yeah, last month we had the lowest number of people to come forward through our DASH intake. And it was kind of shocking to us. We have seen a decline over the last year, and it did start during the pandemic. People weren't able to take time off from work. They were educating their children from home. They were working from home. And also, some of those disincentives that are there that make it difficult for people to donate where, how much is this going to cost? How much time am I out of work? And I think people are faced with that in a different light during that time. And we unfortunately have not seen our numbers bounce back at this point. So we're really trying to kind of get the word out there that we're still here. Unfortunately, the number of recipients that require kidneys is growing as well.
Dr. Palmer, let's talk about that. If I am to be a donor, what does that entail for me? How much time? Well, first of all, how much time in preparation? What is the surgery like? How long to recover? And what is my own prognosis after donating a kidney?
So donors, obviously, they need to be healthy, and their motivation needs to be altruistic. In other words, it cannot be forced upon them by anybody. So as long as you are, willing to help a fellow human being, it can be a relative or not. And as long as you're healthy, as Heather mentioned, the first step is to do this online questionnaire. Then you will do an initial blood testing. One of the obstacles that we find, because we can help to evaluate donors on as short as 2 months from beginning to end to tell them an answer. I mean, the answer may not always be yes, but at least we can give you the answer. But one of the major obstacles for us to do a short time around from evaluation to decision is that because these patients are very healthy, they don't have a primary care doctor. And as a result of that, we got to wait for them to engage and actually to obtain a family care doctor before we can, that is mandated. To be sure that this person has a clean health record. So again, you got to be healthy. You got to be altruistic. Your motivation cannot be forced. And if you go to our website, we can certainly help you do an expeditious evaluation in the amount of a couple months. Now, if for some reason you have some medical issues, we can still help you, but the process may take anywhere from 2 to 4 to 6 months based on your medical issues that you may have.
I'm wondering, if you are a donor, how does that work in terms of insurance? Do most insurance policies pay for it? Does the insurance policy of the recipient, how does that work?
Yeah, as you said, I mean, currently the recipient insurance pays for the evaluation and the testing on the donors. And there is not a limit on the number of donors that it can be evaluated by that will be covered by the recipient insurance. One of the reasons that your audience may not know is if a person stays on dialysis, the yearly cost of dialysis that is paid by the insurer is on average $80,000 for hemodialysis, so $80,000 a year for a person on hemodialysis. So when you do a transplant on the same person, after 2.5 years, the cost curves, they merge. And then after 2.5 years, the person with a successful transplant is less, the cost to maintain those patients is lower than staying on dialysis. And that is the main motivation for the insurers to pay for living donor evaluation, because if the person in need can get a transplant after 2.5 years, they can save money.
Heather, tell me about the people you work with who are donors. Are most of them family members or not really? Are most of them what we call altruistic donors? And what do they tell you about the reasons for donating?
We have a saying here in this office that we are working with the best of the best human beings in the world and on the planet, as far as I'm concerned. Just wonderful, kind, gracious human beings that come forward. Some, like you said, are related. The majority do know somebody, whether it's a family member or even someone that they maybe went to high school with, saw the need on Facebook. But we do have Maine is one of the highest number, the state with the highest number of altruism in the Northeast. We're very fortunate that we have so many people that come forward. So we do see quite a few more than some other centers that have, but just the most willing and wonderful people that come forward either way.
And I understand, Dr. Palma, there are advances. It used to be that we really were looking for a match, but more people can be a match now than there were before. Like blood type doesn't matter anymore. Explain to me what's new.
Absolutely. So that is, it used to be new. It's now a standard of care. So you're absolutely correct. Not too far ago, about 10, 12 years ago, patients in need of a kidney transplant, they had to provide a donor of the same blood type. And so 30% of the patients that they had a person that they wanted to help them, they were not compatible. They could not donate between themselves. So then those patients, basically those donors, were turned away. So here in Maine, since 2013, we are members of this National Kidney Registry. It's like a donor swap at a nationwide scale. So we no longer basically, blood type doesn't matter, because as long as you're healthy and willing to help, the person in need of a kidney transplant, through this organization, we can find you a match. So we've been doing it successfully for more than 10 years. I believe if my memory serves me well, we have done approximately 50, not 60, of those donor exchanges successfully. And the patients, get their kidney transplant, and the donors fulfill their wish to help these patients in need.
Heather, how much follow-up do you all do with the person who has chosen to donate? And what do you hear about their life afterwards? Do people return to it and be honest here, completely regular life after donating a kidney?
The majority of patients do. One of the common things that Dr. Palma and I hear with our patients at their follow-ups are, it doesn't feel like I had anything done. Once they're a year out and resume their regular activity, even at the six-month mark, people start to feel really well and can do everything that they did before. My best friend was a kidney donor about 7 years ago, and I'll mention something about something we're doing outside of work, and she'll say, I don't even really think about it at all until you mention something or Dr. Palma's name pops up. We follow our patients for 2 years. That is our federal regulatory recommendation and requirement, actually. So we will have a two-week post-op check-in with all of our donors, and then we have a six-month, one-year, and two-year follow-up where we're checking BMI, we're checking blood pressure, we're also checking to make sure that your serum creatinine, your kidney function looks good, and in addition to making sure that there's no blood or protein in your urine. So just two small little tests compared to what they do beforehand. It's pretty easy for patients, and we try to make it as accommodating as possible. And we ask questions. How are you feeling? Do you feel like you're at 100% of your normal activity? How are things going? How is your mental health? How do you feel since you donated? And, you know, we welcome anyone to follow up with us after, too. I'm still receiving pictures of people who get married or have children, 5 years after. So it's really important. They become a member of our transplant family.
And let me ask you, Heather, you've mentioned some hard stops, but I don't think you mentioned age. Is there an age limit to who can donate?
Not at our center. No, we do not have an age cutoff. And our oldest donor, I believe, was 81 years old, Dr. Palma, that he actually had surgery and donated to his wife of the like age. And they did a story not too long ago, a couple of years ago, and they were on the news about 5 years after and how well that they were both doing. So they are our oldest couple that I'm aware of.
That's wonderful. Dr. Palma, did you want to chime in there?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, as Heather mentioned, obviously, this 81-year-old donor is literally a superb, human being in terms of aging gracefully. That was my personal career record. I'm optimistic that at some point somebody will beat this patient. So, crossing my fingers that will happen in the near future.
Well, we are talking about live organ donation on Maine Calling. If you'd like to ask a question, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Instagram. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We're talking about live kidney donation today. With me, Dr. Juan Palma, who is Surgical Director and Director of Living Donation at Maine Health, and Heather Stephen, a registered nurse and coordinator of Maine Health's Living Donor Program. And joining us now is Dr. Aji Jamali. He is a nephrologist and chair of the Department of Medicine at Maine Medical Center. He was an external consultant on the xenotransplantation. You may have read about this, the transplant of a pig kidney, and he is also a living donor himself. So if you want to share your comments and questions, do so at talk@mainepublic.org. Call 1-800-399-3566 or find us on Facebook or Instagram. Dr. Jamali, this was big news and is something that I know a lot of people have been wondering about and hoping for a long time. Tell us, for those who did not read the news, what happened and what a big deal this is in your view for medicine.
Sure. Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you for having us, and thank you for having me. As you were talking about this a bit earlier, the need for kidney transplantation is only growing, and we have a limited pool of donors. And as such, it's been a challenge to find resources to make this happen. And xenotransplantation, or transplantation of kidneys from other animal species to humans, has been under studies for a long time. In the past couple of years, we've been successful in doing this kind of transplantation, but primarily in recipients, in human recipients that were brain dead. For the first time in human history, as far as I know, a team from Mass General Hospital at Harvard considered doing a kidney transplant in a patient who was actually alive. And this patient was in his 60s, is in his 60s, was on chronic dialysis, had complications of dialysis, including vascular access problems. So no ability to really continue his dialysis under good care. And on top of that, he had no living donor available. So the patient was going to have a very poor outcome if no transplant was available for him. And the Harvard team was successful in developing a pig that was genetically manipulated with 69 genes being upregulated or downregulated or modified by engineering so that that kidney is better tolerated in humans. But as you can imagine, that is a very high level experimental context and scenario, and they went through all the regulatory processes that were internal. They asked for an external review. That was me, and I was privileged to look at that and thought that it was most appropriate. And of course, the patient was all in favor, and the process went very well. Patient underwent transplantation and was discharged home not that long ago. So this is really groundbreaking. I think that it's a fantastic step for the future of kidney transplantation. It's a stepping stone, and we're all very excited for it.
So your role was to review the whole thing and say, is this an appropriate donor? Is this an appropriate scenario? And you said, yes.
Absolutely. Of course, you know, the team that's local has done their homework. They are a group of multidisciplinary scientists, surgeons, physicians that have done this for a living. They know it's the right thing, but they want to do due diligence and ask for an external expert to confirm their recommendations. And you know, having gone through the process, I thought that it was absolutely appropriate.
So what happens now? You know, I'm sure that everybody is watching this patient very, very closely. At what point does someone deem this surgery a success and successful enough that another patient will have one, or five more, or 10 more, or it will become commonplace?
Absolutely. So that was the first step, right? Now the patient is home. The question is, what will happen midterm and long term? Right now, the average lifespan or the average survival for a kidney transplant is about 10 to 12 years. That's from a human being to a human being. How long can this kidney last in the current recipient? That's the next question. Is he going to tolerate it? Is he going to have rejection episodes that are going to be complicated or not? But regardless of those, this is absolutely a huge step. And I think that in the next year or two, we are going to see more of these happening.
Wow. Well, I want to ask you about the kidney transplant that you personally took part in. But first, I'm going to go to Shannon Butler and her father, Michael Butler. Shannon is a vice president at Island Port Press and donated a kidney to her father. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks for having us on.
Yes, thank you.
Michael, let me start with you. Tell us your story. How did you know? When did you know you needed a kidney?
Well, I was diagnosed with complete kidney failure in June of 2019 at Maine Medical Center, and I began dialysis. I was referred to the Maine Medical Center transplant team and began the process for transplant in February of 2020. I received my kidney from Shannon on April 13th of 2021.
All right. So that's, it's almost your 3-year anniversary then,
two days ago.
Shannon, tell me about your process. Did you start thinking about donating a kidney right away, or did you even know it was possible when your father was diagnosed?
Yeah, somewhere along the way when Dad was sick, it got brought up in a conversation with one of the many doctors that we saw that everything would probably lead to a kidney transplant. And at that time, I mean, Dad was so sick. He went from being healthy dad to critically ill, you know, essentially dying. So it seemed so impossible to think that kidney transplant was in our future. But I do remember thinking on that day, well, I'll do it. I mean, it was not even a question in my mind if I wouldn't. And then, of course, as we proceeded and Dad started dialysis, and he did well on dialysis, but anyone who knows anyone on dialysis, it keeps you well, it keeps you alive, but it's really not a way to live. It severely impacts what things you can do and how you live your life. So I started the process of applying to be a donor right after Dad got healthy enough to be approved for transplant, which was sometime in early 2020, so just before all the COVID things started happening. So I applied in 2020 and started the process. It's a long process of evaluation. You know, they check every part of you, stem to stern. And by December 2020 is when I found out that Dad and I had matched.
So what was it, Shannon, I'm going to stick with you for a minute. What was it like for you? Was it really a big deal to have this surgery? Were you out for a while or not so much?
Yeah, it's a big surgery. Not gonna lie, it's a big one. It didn't help that we were in the middle of COVID. It was April 2021, so things were still pretty rough out there. So I had to quarantine for 2 weeks before and 2 weeks after my surgery, which added a whole another level of complication, kind of to coordinating my life. And then it's a pretty major abdominal surgery. So the recovery, you know, it's not fun. But overall, I think it was 2 days into our hospital stay, I got to go up and see Dad, and he started seeing improvements immediately. I mean, he didn't need dialysis the day he got the kidney, which is amazing. You can't even begin to rationalize in your brain how someone goes from being so sick to well overnight. My kidney started working immediately for him, and you know, getting to see him doing so well really mitigated all of the physical pain I was in. I mean, there's nothing better than watching someone you care for recover and get better. I mean, people say all the time when they talk about loved ones who have passed, like, I would do anything for more time with my dad. I would do anything. And I feel so lucky to have gotten to do the anything. I mean, who gets to say they did that? It's really amazing.
Michael, how are you feeling?
I feel wonderful. 100%. Never better.
Really? So do you live what you would call a normal life?
Very much so.
Wow. Oh, so yes. Really, you're doing better than you were years before your surgery.
Well, yes. It's quite incredible.
Wow. And Shannon, what about you? How do you feel?
100%. You know, I really, after the initial recovery, there's been no real impacts to my life other than the, you know, kind of overwhelming sensation that you save someone's life. But, you know, main transplant has been so awesome. Heather and Dr. Palma were amazing and continue to be amazing and supportive. There's a group of us living donors at the main transplant center who get together to, you know, do advocacy work and spread awareness, but also just talk to each other about, you know, because it's kind of a big deal, I'm not going to lie, about, you know, what we went through, because it's so singular and unique. And I have a hard time imagining that there's anything else I'll do in my life that will come even close to what this was like.
Well, both of you, thank you so much for calling in with such a wonderful story. Congratulations. Shannon Butler with Islandport Press. She donated a kidney to her father, Michael. Shannon, Michael, thank you so much for calling in. We're going to go to another caller now. This is Michael Rafford, and he is an altruistic organ donor from Elliott, Maine. Michael, thanks so much for giving us a call. You just heard the story of Shannon and Michael. You did not know the person you donated a kidney to, correct?
That's correct. Yes, Jennifer.
What inspired you to donate a kidney?
Oh, geez. I mean, there's any number of things, but, you know, I've been very fortunate in my own life with lots of things to be grateful for, and acknowledging those things has always been important to me. I mean, I'll give you a quick example of one, you know, fortunate situation for us. I mean, my wife and I have two sons. Our youngest son is 31, but a little less than 31 years ago, when he was 2 months old, he was diagnosed with a congenital heart defect. He had a hole in between the left and right ventricles or chambers of his heart. So as the blood circulated his heart, it picked up oxygen and was, pumped through the body. But with him, a lot of the blood was sliding through that hole and getting recirculated. So his heart was working overtime. And if it went if we didn't address it, his heart would become muscle bound, his development would be impaired, and he probably wouldn't live to see 20 years old. So we were referred down to Boston Children's Hospital, and when he was 8 months old, we took him down, and he had open heart surgery. They placed a patch over the hole, and, he's been happy and healthy ever since. That was kind of whirlwind for us. The experience was crazy, but, to have the kind of care that we received at Boston Children's Hospital, an hour's drive south from our home in Dover, New Hampshire at the time, was just we were so fortunate. And that's, like I said, I've had other things happen in my life. But as I get older, I always said to myself that at some point I was going to do something impactful for somebody. I didn't know what it was, but I was also intrigued by the fact that most of us are walking around with two functioning kidneys, and we really only need one. And yet there's so many people out there that don't even have one, many through no fault of their own. So when I retired in 2021, I said, now's the time. If I'm going to do this, I got to do it now. I'm not getting any younger, and I feel good, and I have the time. So I reached out to the kidney transplant program up at MayMed and went up and had a consult meeting with Andrew, who's a peer of Heather's, and they're awesome. Really, really nice people. Started the process. So it lasted about 6 months for me. I kind of made it a little bit longer because I blocked out ski season, but I love to ski, and the pandemic obviously kind of drew it out a little bit. But on May 17th of 2022, that was kind of my pay it forward moment, where I went up and Dr. Palmer and his amazing team, removed my left kidney and put it in a transport van, and drove down to Penn Hospital in Philadelphia, and was successfully transplanted into the recipient. So,
Michael, I'm going to ask you to hold on, and I'm going to turn to Heather. And Heather, you want to add something about the way that what Michael Rafford's transplant offering sort of precipitated? What was the snowball effect?
I mean, it's just amazing what these patients will just come to, offer up. Like Mike has talked from the beginning, hey, I've got two kidneys. I know somebody needs one, and I can live with one. And that's been consistent with him, and also making a difference throughout my whole time knowing and working with him, which is beautiful. A family voucher is a program that Mike was able to be part of, too. It started a while ago when donors throughout the country were coming forward with the National Kidney Registry and saying, hey, I really want to donate, but what if at some point in my life, my family member, my son, my daughter, someone might need a kidney? So the National Kidney Registry has made it available for patients that come forward with no one that they have in mind to donate for, where they can name up to 5 family members that have that protection. Now, it's one kidney in, one kidney out. So if there were to be a family member that did require to have a transplanted kidney, then unfortunately the rest of the family would not be able to receive that voucher. However, what they've found is that so many of these donors that are coming forward are so healthy, and if they don't have a family history themselves, then really those kidneys are going to be available if needed for a family member at some time. Hopefully they never will. They've never had to give any kidneys yet, the National Kidney Registry, but they're able to give a living kidney to someone who goes and donates for a family member.
Michael, I want to turn back to you. I know that not all donors or recipients necessarily want to be put in touch with one another. And I'm wondering about your case. Have you been in touch with the person who received your kidney? Do you know who that person is?
Yeah, I do, as a matter of fact. So, you know, the way it works is it's kind of quiet after the surgeries while everybody's recovering. And everything, the communication, if there is any, kind of runs through means transplant, you know, down to the hospital where the recipient was. And I went about a month and didn't hear anything. I talked to Heather and Andrew, and they suggested that I write a letter. I did, basically telling the recipient a little bit about myself and why I donated. And really, I just wanted to know how they were doing. I wasn't necessarily searching out some kind of relationship. I just, you know, wanted to know that they were doing well. Probably 3 weeks later, I got a response. At some point, we exchanged contact information, and we either talk on the phone or text probably once a month. And she's doing really, really well. She has a family. Her husband have a farm in Texas. They raise, cows and grow wheat and corn. She has 8 grandkids and 4 grown children of her own. And she's doing fantastic, which is great. It makes me happy.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for calling in and for your altruistic donation. Michael Rafford is from Elliott and donated a kidney to someone he didn't know. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainpublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today, we're discussing the need for organ donations, in particular, live kidney donations. My guests are all with Maine Health. Dr. Aji Jamali is a nephrologist and chair of Maine Medical Center's Department of Medicine. Heather Stephen, coordinator of the Living Donor Program. And Dr. Juan Palma, director of Living Donation at Maine Health. You can join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email, if you're quick, to talk@mainpublic.org or post to Facebook or Instagram. I'm going to go to some of those emails that have come in. Here's an email from Deej. I am in remission 4 years from lymphoma. Am I allowed to donate a kidney? I think that question goes to you, Heather, right?
Yeah, we typically will wait 5 years, and we'll look at the type of cancer, the treatment, what they had done. We'll request all of those records, and Dr. Palma and our team will look over them and myself very closely to make sure that this isn't an incident where the kidney itself could, after donation, increase harm to the recipient as well, if that cancer can actually follow the kidney with the recipient. So that's something we look at. We do ask for 5 years, typically. Leave remission unless there's skin cancers, and those skin cancers would not be melanoma. That is a rule out, as I said before, for our program. But basal cell, squamous cell, if there has been treatment that has been done and we look at the dermatology notes, then we would move forward. But we just ask for just 5 years of clearance before moving forward.
I have an email here from Carl, who says he grew up on a hog farm, and he's worried about the idea that pig organs could be used in humans due to human and pig organs being similar in terms of diseases jumping from hogs to humans. And I'm wondering, Dr. Jamali, is that a concern that people who are involved in these organ transplants that involve pig organs are concerned about?
Yes, absolutely. That's a great question. And that's one of the reasons that all these studies are being conducted, all the genes are being changed, and patients are being monitored very closely. The multidisciplinary approach and close monitoring will help us determine if that is a risk and how we can address that as soon as it happens, if it happens.
I have an email here from Joanne. Joanne writes, WBUR's On Point program recently covered the many issues impacting U.S. transplant registry and participating hospital programs. A transplant surgeon program guest highlighted safe and timely organ delivery was an ongoing problem. He described receiving expected kidney donations in damaged boxes, and one had tire tracks on the box. Should there be a DHHS mandate to ensure timely and safe delivery practices? Dr. Palma, have you had any problems with delivery of kidneys?
Thankfully, well, not to that extent with like a road tires. I have had kidneys that they've been delayed, but the transplant community is making efforts. Now it's a common occurrence that all kidneys that are shipped in boxes, they have an attached GPS. So now we can do real time tracking of those precious resources. But of course, I mean, there is always a human component. Kidneys, when they travel across the country, the majority, they travel through commercial airlines. And obviously, you know, there's so many people that work for those companies that it's impossible that everything goes smoothly. So other than a few hour delay in the delivery of the kidney, I have not had personally any kidneys damage during transit due to poor handling.
And Dr. Palma, how long is a kidney, I'm using air quotes here, good? You talked about cross-country deliveries. How long after a kidney is removed from a donor can it stay on ice? Is it on ice and still be a healthy kidney for a recipient?
Yes, that's a very good question. You know, it depends on the donor age and, you know, how the kidney function was at the time of the donor passing away. Obviously, as you can imagine, younger donors, those organs are more resilient than older donors. So therefore, they can, you know, quote unquote, last longer. In reality, you know, this for kidneys, which is different than other organs, we only ship kidneys on ice or in what we call perfusion pumps that are only pushing fluid through it. But there's no oxygenation to the tissues. So as you can imagine, the longer it takes for those kidneys to be transplanted, the more chances those kidneys have to be damaged by the lack of oxygen and therefore not work well on the recipient. But as an example, I mean, the cross-country traveling, it is possible, based on the age of the donor, younger donors, a kidney potentially could last 18 hours on ice, 24 hours on ice, and still be transplantable. But again, it's a race against time. You know, we don't want to push it too far because kidneys, you know, may not come around.
Dr. Palma, before the break, Dr. Jamali, before the break, we were talking about your role in the recent newsmaking transplant of a pig kidney to a human. But I want to ask you about something else. I understand that you personally were a kidney donor. When was that? And what was the circumstance? Was this for a family member or a stranger? How did this happen?
Sure. Thank you. Yes, it was on June 30th, 2022. And it was actually to a patient, previous patient of mine, who became a close friend of mine. And this was something that was in my mind for a long time, because I always thought whether I was able to walk the walk myself. Since I evaluate patients and donors on a weekly basis, and I did this for 20 years, and I advised them about the risks and benefits and all the things that we were just talking about, right? And then I thought, okay, if I am so supportive and optimistic, can I do this myself if I'm healthy enough? And the circumstances brought me to this patient, John, who had polycystic kidney disease and reached end-stage renal disease, was in need of a kidney donor. And we had become so close that, in fact, I asked one of my colleague physicians to become his kidney doctors because we were just friends. And as I was moving to Maine from University of Wisconsin-Madison, I announced to John that I was hoping to become his donor. And of course, he was surprised. He was delighted. I was emotionally very touched myself on that day. And when we went through the processes, and as Dr. Palma was saying earlier on, doing the matching, we figured out that we were a perfect match, as if we were like two twin brothers. I was born in Tehran, Iran. He was born in Wisconsin. So just the likelihood of that was absolutely incredible. And that was for us another sign that this was really the right thing to do. And June 30th, 22. We went through it. It went very well. John is doing great. I'm doing great. And it was absolutely a rewarding experience.
Well, I wanted to ask, you say that you've been doing this work for more than 20 years. Has this changed your perspective, being personally being a donor?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I can talk to people who want to donate a kidney, and I can, you know, when I'm on service here and clinical service, I do that. I can advise them. I can show empathy, and I can really help about that. And of course, I want to promote living kidney donation, because I still think that that is the best solution for foreseeable future. And as such, I thought that, you know, if a kidney doctor becomes a kidney donor, you can't really argue against that.
Have you had many of your colleagues reach out to you and ask you about the experience, many of your physician colleagues?
Yeah, absolutely. And it was, you know, also a journey, obviously, because where this happened in Madison, Wisconsin, we were friends with the surgeons who did this, like for 20 years, we were friends. We had worked together with the nursing staff. And yes, they, as well as many other people and colleagues across the country, have been, you know, touching base, and actually many of them very helpful, because, you know, it's a challenging thing to go through, even though you think you are an expert in it. When it is about you going through the process and giving up control and taking the leap of faith, that is a big challenge. So I reached out to many of my colleagues who are absolutely fantastic and helped me a lot.
Dr. Palma, I want to ask you, in the beginning of the program, you mentioned that the waiting list here in Maine is something like 240, 250 people, yet you're only able to do about 50 transplants a year because that's how many donors there are. I'm wondering how many you could do if more people step forward. If you had 1,000 people step forward tomorrow, how many transplants could Maine Health handle in a year?
Well, I don't think that I think that we can handle as many kidney donations they can come our way. I don't think that there's too. It is a large team of transplant professionals. We have nurses. We have two, three transplant nephrologists, and we have two surgeons. I can tell you that with the resources that we have, we can easily double the volume. You know, without putting too much, extra resources. So that would be my answer. Again, you mentioned we had 1,000 more donors. And one of the things that I just like to mention to your audience is, you know, 90% of people are in favor of organ donation. You know, in general polls in the community, 90% of people support organ donation, but only 60% of us are registered into donor registries. So there is a gap of 30% of people that if we all sign our license, if we all put our names into donor registries, that will generate 30% more transplants every year in the U.S., so that is something that I would like to mention for your audience consideration, and that would be a huge advantage for us.
And let me ask you, we focus mainly, we have so little time left and I have so many more questions, but we focused on live organ donation. If someone is to die, can a kidney be taken from somebody who is near death or has just died in, say, a car accident or something like that?
Yeah. First of all, there is two types of deceased donors. The most common one is the brain dead donor. Basically, you get into an accident, your brain is gone, and then your name is in the donor registry. They will notify your family, and the organ bank will immediately proceed to honor your wishes, because I mean you sign into the donor registry, so you want to be an organ donor. So that's how the donation happened for that particular donors. There is other donors that they are not brain dead, but their medical situation is terminal. So then those donors also, if their names are in the donor registry, they can participate as a donors. So that is basically the way that a person, you know, after an accident or a terminal medical illness can become an organ donor.
Okay. Well, we are out of time. The web address, if you want to be learn more, mmc.donor.screen, right, Heather? And I want to thank you all, Dr. Juan Palma, Surgical Director and Director of Living Donation at Maine Health, Heather Stephen, a registered nurse and coordinator of the Living Donor Program at Maine Health, and Dr. Aji Jamali, a nephrologist and chair of the Department of Medicine, also a living donor. Today's sound engineer was Sandra Harris. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.